topic under consideration this morning is church music of the present and future. There's a certain amount of just guesswork on my part as to what the future does mean in music, of course, but based on trends and things that are happening, it's easy to make a fairly good judgment of exactly what will be happening or what I think you will see happening as the years progress. As far as the present situation stands, where music stands today, of course, we all come from varying backgrounds, and it means, first of all, that there are going to be various styles which are prevalent. We can't all fit under one church music style. When I'm speaking of church music this morning, I'm going to refer, as I did the other day, to music dealing with either in the choral or congregational sense, rather than going into, in this case, works for special occasions and organ music and things of this nature. The 20th century has seen quite a radical departure from previous centuries, in that previous centuries, for the most part, had one main style of music going. You had a Baroque era, you had a Romantic era, and with very few exceptions, people stayed within the limits of whatever they were supposed to be composing. When you come to the 20th century, things have gone so many different ways that you say it's a contemporary way, but when that gets to be the 21st century and they're speaking of their contemporary way, how will they put ours down? There are actually several things that are going on at once rather than there just being one style at this present time. So after the First World War, when Romantic music had sort of seen its end for the most part, there had been an enormous desire to combat the sort of wearing emotion on your sleeve idea of writing, and they came back the other way with music that was more abstract. You have, as I played some the other night, you have Debussy, where you don't have as romantic a thing as you might have when Wagner was writing his operas, and you get more into the idea of type of thing, writing, and not as perhaps as much in the immediate, it had more of a mood that it created as far as acceptance. There were also others at the same time who were writing in a much more stringent style, a desire to completely annihilate this idea of creating emotions in music and letting music simply stand as an art form. By having music this way, of course, and this was, I played an example last the other evening in the Webern variations, you get music that is very much worked out in a mathematical sequence, music that is very much devoid of having an emotional element, that is, an emotional element that's written into it. Of course there's an emotional element because it has to affect you some way or another. You are either turned on or turned off or turned some way, so it does affect you, but they are not striving to have you receive the same emotional element, all of you at once. So, with this general idea of these two diverging lines going, and still underneath was the old Romanticism. I mean, it's still there. We went underground for a little while, but it was still fairly fluent. These various forms of music have all kept and all have started, to varying degrees, started to come into the modern-day church. People have said that you can always count that whatever is happening in music, the church is usually a good generation behind. And this has been true. I think that in the present day, we're seeing a bit more of catching up than had been in previous times. Now, one other thing that makes the whole realm of 20th century music sort of unusual is that in every other century, up, not including our own, the music of that era, the music they were writing, that a composer was writing, for the church or for any idiom, was immediately, for the most part, accepted by the people, say for the church. He wrote something for the church, fine, let's sing it. This is it. He didn't have to worry about composers of previous eras. For For instance, an 18th century composer wasn't going to be worrying about whether someone in the 17th or 16th century had set that same text to music and whether his was going to be better or worse than someone previously, mainly because they didn't even know about a lot of these things that had happened before, so they didn't have a hang-up wondering whether or not they were going to be writing something or trying to compare. In the 20th century, you know, someone says, I think I'll write something, I think a Christmas work entitled Messiah would be nice. Well, as soon as you do that, handle, and everybody's like this, wondering what's going to happen, there's always these immediate comparisons, and a 20th century composer sort of has this hanging over his head, because our whole way of writing music has changed so greatly. We're so much more now concerned with what the past has had, and historically, where what we can take from, so that music, in a sense, does not always just strive on this way, but sort of is moving on this way, but kind of grabs and pulls this back, and we are always recreating old composers. This we're in the midst of right now is sort of a Baroque renaissance in music, and of course what has happened to a great deal is that we've gone back to discover a lot of old Baroque composers, some of whom actually would have been better off left in the grave than have been brought up to the present. Just like in any era, you have good composers and you have bad, but to all of a sudden, you see, we get this fascination with an older era, and so we grab the music of this older era, and we say, oh, this was the golden era. There wasn't any fault in this one, and we just grab these pieces up. This week, choir, we're going to sing this great motet by Gumpelzheimer, and the next week, we're going to do this wonder, and you hear all these composers, and people, oh, I never heard of it. Doesn't matter. It's good music. It's Baroque. It's good. Which is not true, because as in any era, you have, you know, they just all weren't that much on the ball. And then, of course, too, even the great composers, gee, a lot of times it just depends on what they had for breakfast before they composed, my word, you know. Cold bowl of oatmeal and the piece didn't come out so well that day, you know. They're writing fluently, tons of work. It's amazing how much these people were putting out. Well, so this is sort of a hang-up that we have in the 20th century. Everyone, sort of, in dealing with music, is this comparison with the past that is a great part of our music. This said and done, we come to where we stand now in relation to church music. There are several ways that church music has gone. We have had the, what we might want to call, for lack of a better term, the English Victorian hymn anthem type of thing, which has resulted in a great number of choral pieces that have been derived from a choir, from a hymn, and set to music for choir with variations and the things like this. And this is a rather standard, straightforward kind of anthem. An example of that, it doesn't always have to be based on a hymn tune, but an example of that might be With a Voice of Singing, maybe a lot of you know. This kind of writing, very much accessible, very much the kind of thing that the audience starts, sit back, fine, you know, this is good, straightforward, a good praiseworthy anthem, kind of anthem that you enjoy hearing. It has a tendency to get a little tiring on repeated hearings, that is when you hear it three times within 3 months, kind of thing. Hey, that's a good one. Let's do it again soon. You know, that kind of feeling. But it has its place. It's had a lot of importance in the field of church music, and it's certainly been one of the big things that has happened as far as providing music for the church. The other thing has been that with the 20th century, we've seen so many publishing houses come up, so many people, so many different printing firms, that it's much, much easier now for a composer to get his work published and consequently get it sung, that it's just, you know, the market has been flooded, and it's been flooded with an awful lot of trash. I do my darndest to keep up on all the current choral music that's coming out, and as Carolyn only knows too well, there are too many packages coming in daily and weekly, but it's just amazing the junk that comes, and, you know, just it's literally like it's just being hashed out, and here it comes, and another anthem's on the way. And so it's rather difficult sometimes to sit there with a microscope and really a microscope in your mind, actually, and figure out, now just, is this good music or have we got another piece of trash? Because you would never be able to sing all of the stuff that's being published in the current days. And just to keep abreast of it is really gets to be quite a challenge. So you have this very standard, straight down the line medium of writing. Another trend that is very popular because of the school of 12-tone music that we spoke of the other night, of Schoenberg and Webern, is that music has been composed for the church, not as much, mainly because it hasn't caught on, but it's been composed by composers who really are not concerned, as the one I just played was, with whether or not the music was accepted by the general people. Webern wrote his piece, he did not write it saying, oh, I've got to write something that the people are going to love. Not at all. He wrote it because he had a conviction to write it. He felt, this is what I must write, this is what I feel. Will they accept it? I don't know. I rather doubt it, but nevertheless, I must write this work. So this is the style that has led to a number of choral pieces. They're extremely interesting. They take an enormous amount of rehearsal, and it certainly is not the kind of music that at the first rehearsal a choir is generally going to go wild over. Yet I have found, in occasion of using pieces of this nature, that once they have been learned, which takes some time, and used in a situation in church where you present it well, both before you do it, as well as the actual performance, that is, some words of explanation to the congregation, that usually the response has been, if certainly not overwhelmingly favorable, at least not, oh, I never want to hear that again. So much, you know, is so important on how these things are presented. Just, you know, bombing out an anthem on Sunday morning with, especially something unusual, with no word of warning to a congregation is really rather unfair. At least I think it is. And I'm always very concerned that the congregation be as much with it as they possibly can. When I use an unusual organ prelude or an organ postlude on a Sunday morning, especially a prelude, that I have a feeling is going to cause quite a bit of question amongst the congregation as to, well, what exactly is going on in this particular piece. I'm not speaking of this every week, but when I do, I balance out the whole year anyway as to what I play. I'll always make sure that there's a word in the bulletin about the piece, what the composer was trying to do, what the piece represents, something of this nature, because otherwise the audience is really left quite cold, not quite understanding what exactly is happening in the organ loft that morning. And so this, I think, is very important. Well, so you have this whole trend. Where this has led to our present day is to quite a bit of music that has gone into the area of non-expression music. That is, you have no way of really having control over it, because it's gone to a point of electronics and using, say, a tape that can be interspersed with an anthem, sounds that are hummed, spoken, coughed, yelled, hard to say what. A new anthem that just came out last year, for instance, the Norwegian composer Knut Nystedt has written an anthem called Praise to God, which, if you were to take a copy of it and read through, might say, oh my, well, let's see now, where was with the voice of singing, you know. But it's really quite a fascinating anthem, and a good recording of it, I mean a good hearing of it, is well worth something. He has, for instance, I can't duplicate it on the piano because it does not sound the same. He will take, say, seven voice parts, seven divisions per voice part. So the basses might start, this is on the word something like, let us all our tongue employ. And the basses have all come in on those seven tones. And then while they're holding these, you get the tenors coming in. Then when the altos have come in and the sopranos, so that you have a chord of approximately duration, then the whole group moves up together. I can't do that on the piano because it does not, if I go, you know, it doesn't sound like anything, but it's an extremely effective medium when done, and they go up and down like this. Very, I will guarantee that the congregation will sit up and listen. I don't guarantee what their reaction may be, but I know that it's a, It's a new way, and it's a new desire to do something with a particular text. Then later on, when the men are singing the words praise to God, immortal praise, the women are saying, sing ye. And it's like, sing ye, sing ye. Only it's sing, 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 you know, three different groups, so that there's continuous cascading of just singing going on. And the altos are doing the same thing on about an F, I think. There's just rumbling of tone going on all the time, and meanwhile the men in unison are singing praise to God, immortal praise, kind of writing. And when all of a sudden at the end, I don't remember the ending exactly, except that all of a sudden if you have something like major chord, you go, oh my word, you know, it just sort of hits you. And he does it directly. Had the whole piece been performed of, you know, that last chord, when you finally hit praise, you know, fine, it's over. But when it comes after all of that, and it just, oh my, you know, it's really, it has quite an effect. Another work of that era, of that genre, that has created quite a bit of attention is a work that we in Minneapolis premiered 2 years ago called The Passion of Christ According to St. Luke by the Polish composer Krzysztof Penderecki. And Penderecki writes very much in the same kind of idea of what I've just described, only it's a long work telling of the whole Passion. It goes into great detail describing the Passion in musical terms quite a bit like this, but more difficult to sing because the chorus is divided into 12 parts. And it goes into quite a bit of detail, but all of a sudden at the end, when there's been these enormous sounds, musical sounds, when they're saying something like, would be as if you were saying, I know that my Redeemer lives, or something like that, and you set it to, you know, and it's just over, but it's this final big major chord that comes. So the composers are not averse, when I say this, they're not averse to using what we might want to call common tonality, you know, chords that we're familiar with, that we can easily recognize and hum. Like if I gave you, you know, ya-da-da-da, you'd have it, but if I gave you, ya-da-da-da, you know, where is that chord? Kind of feeling, they're not averse to writing in a strictly tonal sense. It's just that they feel that you can broaden it more and get more effect by going. So this is another whole side. The third side of what's happening in church choral music is what would, of course, be coming under the pop idea of writing. And there's been quite a bit of this ever since 1956 when Geoffrey Beaumont wrote his folk mass. And this created a big stir and has since created quite a large stir in music circles, and there have been many variations since then. Now one of the new trends is to go outside of our own writing and see what other countries have done, which has of course brought African mass and Indian ideas in, and various countries and South American rhythms and various other ideas that have been brought into the mass. This whole school has led to a sort of a pop, well, it would be like in the 1920s and 30s when pop music, much of what is like today, was being written for dancing. It was music that really on its own wasn't such great music, but when you're dancing you don't really listen to the music that much anyway. And consequently it fit the mood very well. It's very rhythmic and vital. And this, of course, is what has happened today. We have a lot of this pop music. The only problem, of course, is that we're not dancing to it any longer. Consequently, we're listening to it a little more, and it's getting a little dull. Some of it's very good, but some of it is really quite a bit of boredom as far as participating in time after time. One of the composers who has, among others, there's a whole school of English composers who've been very active in this. One of them is John Gardner, who has set some hymns in popular style, such as... Sunday morning. We will now hear Abide With Me. You know, you're bound to get a little reaction that way. And he has set five of these very much in this style. They're not all like that. They're, each one is a little different. But it's a completely new way to certainly to think about setting the songs. Another composer is Malcolm Williamson, who writes... kind of writing, and it happens to be a very long anthem, that particular one. Very nice, but boy, it gets on. It goes into the King of Love, My Shepherd Is. You may all think you know a setting, but there is. The King of Love, My Shepherd Is, whose goodness filleth me. I'm nothing like if I am his, and he is my forever. Yeah, very nice. The King of Love, My Shepherd Is, whose goodness. It's also very difficult to sing because the rhythms go and it's. Quite unusual. So there's a whole school of this pop thing. Here's an example of some other pop. Music. They've gone, for instance, in a setting of the 150th Psalm. You might get into something like. And this is all in this realm of their desire to get a more active participation from the congregation through this medium. The difference, of course, between that and what I just described previously is that here you have composers who are actually writing something that they are writing because they want to make sure that the congregation likes it. That takes a completely different style of writing and a completely different frame of mind than writing something that you feel is good for the church, and you're trusting that as people get to know it, they will be able to appreciate it. You've got two different sides of the coin. So these then form the three ways that music now stands. I should bring in also at this point what's happening in the hymn writing. The 19th century, we had a great deal of the good old solid hymns of Dykes and others that came into prominence. And in addition to these people, the 20th century has continued that with, the turn of the century before that with Sankey and his gospel hymn writing. A lot of what he did has been continued by other people. Certainly it's been noticeable in the sessions in the Billy Graham Crusades. And this has been one of the things, actually, that many church musicians have been a little turned off about, is the fact that Graham has unfortunately let the group use second-rate music oftentimes in his crusades. And it's really kind of a shame when you're... But of course, it's the idea of dealing with the people and what will they like, and not rather what it's not the idea of beating something over their head, but it's the idea of uplifting, and this is the way they feel that they can appeal. The only thing with, of course, a lot of hymn writing and a lot of music of this type is that you end up with music that really is rather banal, and once you finish singing it, it really has no more edifying purpose. It's all gone. Contemporary hymn writers are trying to do what they can. The turn of the century was John Ireland, who composed a really gorgeous hymn, number 65 in our hymnal, My Song is Love Unknown, which is really one of the most beautiful tunes and a very singable one that, I don't mean John Ireland, but this particular one, this one came from Edwards, who was prior to him. And the era that produced this kind of song that was very tuneful and very devotional and the kind of thing that does not dull on repeated hearings. I think with a good tune, you know, you can use it fairly often and you still are able to emit a fine response from people time after time. Another abrupt change from that, of course you all know, you should at least, one of the big tunes that caused a big stir was 144.
Let me make sure I'm right.
Yeah, first tune, 144, was sort of the start of 20th century hymn writing when Vaughan Williams wrote Signa Nomina for All the Saints and created quite a good stir. It's a rousing, good hymn. Sometimes I wish there weren't quite so many verses, but that's all right. When you have a good long, if you can make use of a good long processional, sometimes it works out. Anyway, this was an example of the new kind of style of hymn writing. It didn't stay so much within a few notes. It moved out a little bit more. Now, they went beyond that. Geoffrey Shaw, 551, when he wrote his version, the first tune of Stand Up for Jesus, there have been four versions of Stand Up for Jesus. They only have two in the hymnal. And there was the one that went... Oh, big old favorite English one. It used to be in all the hymnals. That was a big favorite. But very dull, because all you did was sit, you know, stand up for Jesus, ye soldiers of the cross. Then you said, by his royal banner, it must, oh, you know, really, after a while, there are other notes besides B and C on the scale. So along comes Geoffrey Shaw, who thought, I'll make up a new tune. And it's really quite a nice tune. The only problem is it's a little difficult to sing. And it takes a little congregational learning. I think it's got a real spirit to it, but this era, you see, where for so long original tunes were not forthcoming from the church, people were content to write very pedantic little tunes and little melodies that really are not that well worth remembering. We only remember many of them just because they're associated with a certain set of words. Had these been in the popular vein of writing, they wouldn't have made it beyond the first year, you know. No disc jockey would have kept them on. But we remember them because they're associated with a certain set of words, and oftentimes this is their only reason for staying in existence. Anyway, number one here, it has a few... The jumps are have sometimes provided a problem. You boys, Jesus! You know, they can't quite find where that low note comes. But it's really quite a nice setting. One has to teach the congregation, and I have no bad feelings at all about teaching congregations new hymns. In fact, I think it's just great. I don't think the way to teach it is to present the hymn one Sunday and then sing it again 6 months later. Nobody learns that way. But certainly, with a new hymn, a repeating situation, like once every week for a month, usually gets it fairly well learned. I usually start by having the choir sing it through instead of just the congregation. The congregation's always usually a little embarrassed if they've never heard the tune before, and I don't blame them. If they don't read the music, it's a little hard. But I had very fine success with a number of tunes this way that I felt were here in the book and ought to be learned, and people have, you know, a lot of requests, oh, could we sing that one again, or this one's a very good one. And there are a number of new tunes which have come in this book. Not too many. This is a rather conservative book in that respect. The new Lutheran hymnal that will be coming out in several years should be much more progressive. and much more ready to bring in newer aspects, for instance, the pop medium and folk medium into the new hymnal. So if we're here at the present, where do we come? Well, then the future, first of all, of course, hymn writing doesn't change that much. My feeling is that it won't. I think the new hymnal might see a few more of the folk type of songs that will come in, perhaps a few new songs that are written, hopefully a few taken out, hopefully not so much use of the same tunes. I think this hymn book uses, I'll know very soon, I don't want to quote the number. Oh, it only uses it four times. I thought it used it five. The tune Duke Street. Is used four times in this hymnal for four different set of words. There, to me, is no reason why it couldn't be used once for one set of words and we could find three other tunes to fit the other three sets. Because, in fact, one of the ones is very stilted and doesn't work out. And then, of course, the tune that goes... take out the second verse in the new hymnal. Some work in sultry forests where apes swing to and fro. It's got to go. That is one I will never use. Never. Congregation says, some work in sultry forests where apes swing to and fro. But it's in there. Just a sec. 317. Yeah, the choir in front of the church, terrible. It's like the Sunday morning that my minister was announcing the death of a woman, Myrtle Pickle, in the parish. And I don't know, it just caught me funny. And he announced, he says, we're so sorry to, and I have three services. And so he announced at the first service, we're so sorry to announce the passing this morning of Myrtle Pickle. And I'm where he can see me, but the audience can't. And I just kind of smiled big because it really kind of caught me funny. And he saw that. And the next service, you know, it was like where he stands and here I am. I'd like to announce, and he just looked away because he knew I was laughing. By the third service, I was just gone, you know. It's just somehow I was ready for it to happen. And just I don't know why, but that dear name just sort of hit me. And Myrtle Pickle. And then, of course, a year on the death, there was flowers up there for her. The pickle flowers were up there. Oh, dear. It was, well, these things happen. Of course, I have a big fascination with funny names anyway, but we won't get into that. I keep this big, long list of names I've collated from various places that are unusual. The hymn book, I think, will stay quite a bit the same, hopefully taking out a certain number of these hymns. We're sort of gradually and thankfully, I think, getting out of the era where we feel that emotionalism, that emotion in music can't be an inward thing, but we've got to wear it on our sleeve where all can see it type of thing, you know, where a really good hymn isn't a good hymn unless we have a good cry over it or this kind of thing, which it was actually a fairly prevalent thing. It's like singing Just As I Am. Oh, let's have just one more verse. And, you know, finally we've sung 25. And this kind of emotional kind of pitch that feels that there can't be a feeling inside. You really don't have feelings unless you show them. The church I'm at had for many years the custom of on Good Friday of a lady who had to sing the Old Rugged Cross kneeling at a cross. And that's just one thing I just said no. You know, that's not part of the music program. Where, you know, this is not a drama opera group operating here, and I just strongly did not feel that this was the correct way of presenting it. I don't happen to like that hymn, but if she had wanted to sing it as a solo, I would not have raised violent objections, but I just didn't feel that... I felt that the message of the song could be gotten across just as well singing it as kneeling by some cross singing it. Of course, she quit the choir for a while after that, but she came back. And this kind of thing where you have to wear it so openly, and there are certain hymns in the hymn book that definitely were written for that very purpose. That was the reason they are composed, and you know, we start singing them with the idea of trying to emit this very kind of response. I think we're sort of growing out of this. We're finding that music does not have to always have to have that certain kind of writing. So I think you'll see this happening, and I think perhaps a little more livening. The idea of bringing in, I get asked questions about, what do you think about bringing instruments in? And of course, this is becoming more and more. This is certainly fine, I think, that there's no reason why music can't have the addition of other instruments besides just the organ, or even without the organ. My only strong feeling on that point against it is, I think one always has to keep in mind, no matter what the medium or what you're using in music, is to make sure that the music, first of all, is not being used strictly as an effect, something really cool for the service. The idea of bringing in a guitar because, man, it's really neat and different type of feeling turns me so far off that I would not allow it. When somebody says they want to use it, I'll say, for what reason? What will it do to enhance the service? And I've had people tell me good reasons, and I had a girl who sang a solo in church using the guitar. Fine, and I have nothing wrong with it. I mean, you know, I'm willing to use it, here's one example, but I mean, I'm willing to use it quite a bit and use anything as long as there's a real reason why it should be used. But just to say, well, everybody's doing it, or man, it really sounds keen when you do, type of feeling, I don't think that's really valid, because that's not the purpose of music. Music is an integral part of the service, not just a little flash in the pan that you add because this will be a cool effect to have on a Sunday morning. Or man, wait till they hear this, boy, will they be shocked. Type of feeling. For instance, I have an anthem coming up this Christmas that uses just choir and string bass. It's a jazz piece that is based on Unto Us a Child is Born by a contemporary German composer, Heinz Zimmermann. And it's very much with the bass, just, you know, the plucking kind of type of thing, and the choir is singing, Unto us is a child born, a son is given to us, type of writing. And this kind of thing, I feel, by itself puts the bass sometimes in the position of, well, does that really fit? And some people feel that some people would be, in a sense, turned off because they would hear the bass doing that and they say, this kind of anthem doesn't fit that well into the service. Well, there are other ways to get around this, one of them being that that same service, I will have the bass player, of course that will be with the finger, but I'll have him do a duet with the organ for the organ prelude for that morning. There are some nice bass solos, bass fiddle solos that fit very well, nice, very legato songs. And by hearing the bass in that kind of thing, which 99% of the people never have, they only think of the bass as being able to do this, all of a sudden puts it, in a different idiom, so that when you finally do an anthem that does have the plucking, I find it much more acceptable to people. And I'm not trying to say that things have to always be down the road acceptable, but I think that when people find a reason for why they can accept it, they're more likely to get the message which you're trying to get behind it, and that's the whole point. My whole point in the end is not strictly to provide a Sunday morning when I can use a bass in church, but that I have a text to provide which, in order for its complete enhancement, needs that particular instrument. Now there, you can operate, and there you can use the instruments. That's why there's no reason why brass has to be used. It must be used only on Easter. There are many other times during the year. Mary Hinderby was telling me of going to, she was sick one summer and she just walked down a block and went to St. Mark's Cathedral in Minneapolis. And some little Sunday in the middle of July, some hot Sunday, there was a brass sextet there playing. She said, my word, it just sort of like, she says, it was just one of the Sundays after Trinity, you know, no big special festival. And she says, it was just marvelous just to add something to the worship service. And certainly this is fine. There's no reason why these kind of things can't be. So I think that in terms of music in the church and expression this way is fine. Of course, many verses in the Psalms speak of this very kind of thing, and I think it's great that they do, and I think it's something that's very important. So we have all of this kind of thing happening. In the field of choral music, I think you'll see more trends along the same line. I think there'll always be, because all churches and all people are not going to go to the same, you'll always have this strong romantic group of anthems that will always be quite a bit in vogue. You'll also see, I think, a great deal more of effects coming into music. Speaking pieces, you know, pieces where the choir might just go, haste to God, type of thing. You know, well, which is not certainly at this time the common thing, but it sort of wakes people up to the fact that God can be praised not only in singing, but in speaking sounds as well. And so I think you'll see this kind of thing coming more and more. Certainly more effects, having electronic tape playing. If you've never heard a piece of electronic music, you really you owe it to yourself. Again, it's something I can't describe. You have to hear it. And you have to hear it live. On a recording, it doesn't really, you don't really get the effect. But if you've got a live group of people either singing or playing, and in the background there's some tape going on, it's really quite an interesting experience. If it's a good composition, again, like anything else, there are good and bad tapes. And so you have to make a judgment there. But I think this will be seen. I think there'll be a lot more of this kind of thing. There will always also be this intellectual approach to music that has been characterized through the years by a number of composers. And they will always continue mainly because they feel they have something to give to the church, whether the church is anxious to accept it or not. And for this reason, there will always be a great deal of this kind of music coming forth. So these kind of things, I think, will always be done. I think that as far as music on the sleeve, emotionalism, I think you'll see in choral music this coming back just a little bit. I don't think this will be quite as obvious, mainly because the choral, the people who are composing it are finding out that they're getting a smaller and smaller amount of music being sold because of the fact that it is so completely over, it's this over-obvious approach to music. And people right now are anxious for something a little more held back and not quite so obvious to them, something that they can have a little more, they can get a little more power and a little more substance out of. That, I feel, is sort of where things are going in music. Do you have any questions about things you've heard or questions you might have had, either about just this hymn book, something that might have bothered you, or just about music itself? Anything? Well, pop music for teenagers today, first of all, is used to a great extent always in the form of dancing. And as in anything else, I think that there certainly is a place where we're sort of allowing, I think, in the church too, a lot more of the humanitarian aspect of texts to come into the church. Well, for instance, last night's Vespers, bringing in the Sound of Silence. Now, it was certainly never written for a church. I mean, it was written for, you know, a graduate? Yeah. And the idea of bringing in a few of these things text-wise has changed to a certain idea, the idea of service in the church. I think, personally, that there are always, and this is a personal thing because each of us feels differently about it, my feeling is that there should be and always will be a fine line of difference between church and secular music. Should we say religious and secular music? This is not to mean that the secular music will never come into the church, because I think that on occasions when it has when it again serves a purpose, it should. But I think for the strict purpose of edification, for praise and for glory, that there is a difference between music that was composed for that purpose and music that never was composed for that purpose, but was composed strictly on an emotional level on the outside. As far as it coming in, as far as that type of music, we're seeing a little bit of it. Some of the earlier, what now, of course, what we would laugh at in terms of rock music, what was composed back in the early 1950s when Elvis Presley was just getting started, and some of these things are now considered so basic, and we're a little behind because some of this kind of thing is now just kind of very gingerly being composed into church anthem type things or into choral response. There was another one in here that might interest you. There's a movement in England trying to set pop words with a religious twist. very much in the rock idiom. There's here's one. You've got a rock to scare your blues away. You've got a rock to turn your night to day. That rock is capitalized, by the way. You've got a rock that will not roll away. It's true. You've got the strongest rock that's ever been. You've got a rock, and on it you can lean. You've got a rock, for that's what Christ can mean to you. Set to, of course, a rock idiom. Then there's the thing. There's a rhythm in the way God has given every day. Every morning and evening is a new creation telling the story of God. And all of these particular ones are set very much in a rock idiom, probably in a more, in an easier, more basic rock than what we are. Right now we're coming into a very sophisticated, in fact, the rock music that's now coming out, some of the later Simon and Garfunkel things and some of the things like of the Fifth Dimension, are reaching a point where serious, where I shouldn't say serious, I should say classical musicians, like myself, who are based in a classical vein of operating, are really enjoying them because they're harmonically so interesting the way they go. They're not the traditional kind of, you know, type of thing where you had about four chords and that's all you ever did, which is, of course, one of the reasons that I think folk music has certainly its quaintness and believability, and yet I know myself, I've gone to folk programs where it seems like every folk song is either an F or C, because those are two easy chords to play in, and after a while, I personally get very tired because I think, gee, there are other keys. There's about, you know, I know of 11 other keys, you know, 10 other keys that you could be using, and they're a little hard to play, and so consequently, they're not sometimes not used. But I think that this kind of thing, especially songs like, you get into things, as a very basic example, I'm probably quite a number of you have heard Up, Up and Away, which has a very interesting harmonic sequence. It's not the kind of song that you wouldn't probably sing it, mainly because you wouldn't get the melody just exact, but you kind of get the general idea. And it's a real challenge for the musician to sit down and try and remember where the chords went, because it gets to be kind of a complicated deal. So this kind of thing is catching on. It's becoming kind of a sophisticated thing. And for this reason, rock music is appealing more now to your post-high school group. It appeals to the high school group also. But it now is starting to be able to envelop the post-high school group because it has a sophistication about it that it never had before. You know, before it was a very, you got a hard day's night, and I've been working, kind of thing where that was all it was. And now it's starting to take on all kinds of new things because it's got texts that are much more, they're not so, you know, hard day's night type thing. It's much more, it's got all kinds of variants to them. And it's starting to do it. So I wouldn't have any surprise at all if this starts to include things much more into the church.
Does the new hymnal bring down all the 18th and the 19th centuries in your mind? Some people say, oh, why can't we go back to the old hymns? Well, those are new hymns. Why can't we really go back?
Yeah, they're going to have more of the. Yeah, they're going to have a lot more of the older. Yeah, they'll have a lot more hymns of the 15th and 16th century in there. They'll cut out quite a number of 19th century hymns. Let's say they'll prune the 19th century hymns a little bit. And, of course, I know which ones I'd like to have pruned, but that's personal. There are, you know, everyone has their own little choices. No, we wouldn't. No, no, we wouldn't. No, everybody has their little ones.
Are you on the committee for the
music? No, Lee Saturn is, and he was, the committee, as is always the case, I shouldn't say always, because there probably were cases when it wasn't true, whether I know one in England where it wasn't, but as the most cases, your music hymnal is always composed of theologians and pastors and maybe one or two musicians thrown on just to make sure that it looks like a hymn. Oh, it's standard practice, you know. Consequently, the hymnal always, this is one of the reasons why you end up with, you know, five sets of words with the same tune. Well, that always was so nice with that tune, and I do like it, so let's use it a few times, kind of feeling. So this is so often the case with these kind of things. One or two musicians, and Saturn, since the last hymnal, he was on this committee, but he was the youngest member and had virtually no voice, has grown, of course, in musical stature as far as people knowing about him is concerned, and because of that fact, for instance, he has more say on the new book coming out. Though certainly, again, I will be surprised. I don't know the whole committee, but if I were to see the list, I would be surprised if it was composed of even half. Oh, that would be unbelievable. Half of the committee being musicians in a music hymnal. Because, you know, really, it's a silly. You think that it's half music and it's half poetry, so that you have a division, half and half.
Yeah. Excuse me, this committee you're talking about, is this the one that the joint effort you're talking about with all of the
groups? Yeah.
Will this be for all seven of the section?
Well, I think that's what they would like to hope that it would be. Yeah, I wouldn't think it would, you know.
Well, a lot of pastors have to do for music.
That what?
A lot of pastors have to do musical ability.
Oh, yeah. No.
No,
I don't say that, but I just know that I don't remember specific examples, but I do remember once mentioning this with Lee Saturn and some of the things that had gone on in the last one. And, well, my congregation always liked this hymn. I know that it's really not that good, but really it's, could we, softly and tenderly, let's keep it in, you know, kind of thing. And the Finnish Lutheran Church would not buy the hymnal unless there were certain ones put in. And, you know, this whole, you know, very common kind of procedure that exists. Well, if this hymn's not here, you won't get your order, you know. It's really kind of a shame. But this is the human side of anything, and this is always part of it. You can't get away. Well, this would be strictly a hymnal for the Lutheran Church, this one. There are hymnals that are in use that are designed for all, you know, there are interdenominational hymnals. I don't think they'll ever catch on, mainly because every church has their own background, which presupposes that there's going to be one certain style of music. For instance, I'm sure that these interdenominational hymnals wouldn't include as many chorales as the Lutheran Church would want to have in them, or other types, and this would hold true for just about any type of music. One kind of music I did not mention, and I don't know how many of you are even familiar with it, but I ought to just mention it because it's extremely widespread, is in many of the evangelistic churches, there is always, to me, a very incongruous characterization of music. The people, so often I'm speaking in a very conservative evangelistic church, so often, you know, there's the strong point against worldliness in every shape, form, and figure, you know, no movies, shows, all this kind of, I mean, I grew up, I'm very familiar with this whole way of operating, and it, of course, came out of the last century Victorian morality idea. Well, one of the interesting things about the evangelistic churches, that is to many of them, this is not true of all, but in many churches, is that whereas they will not accept so-called worldly enticements, and of course Hollywood is, you know, paramount to a swear word, the music that they allow in the church is honest, if you could just change the words, it would be, you know, tomorrow's hit tune. And they say, oh, the hit tune. Oh, you know. And they are. An example.
I love these examples. This is one of Carolyn's favorite songs. Right? She always gets very disturbed when I play these. But I can't believe them, because this is, of course, the kind of church that puts Christ on the level of your pal, you know, and kind of thing, and it's, the music has that same kind of character. Here's one. Maybe these are familiar to you, I don't know.
Over the sunset mountain, someday I'll softly go into the arms of Jesus, He who has loved.
Kind of thing, you know, or dance in the church. Pop songs with the religious words. I mean, old pop songs.
Hear Christ calling to you.
Oh, no, I'm not going to do any more of that one. Yes, 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 yes. So, this is a... It would be amaze you the millions of dollars spent every year by churches and individuals who feel this is religious music. Now here you're getting to the core of church music. So you see, here's another whole, I almost neglected to mention this, and it's amazing how widespread this is. This kind of thing that is very, very prevalent. And this kind of thing also precludes that you will dramatize. If you were to present Handel's Messiah, you would dramatize it, you know, which I also saw once. That's quite something. And suddenly there was with the angel a multitude of the heavenly host, praising God and saying, curtains, whoosh, and there's 200 angels. Glory to God! You know? Oh, yes. So, this is that, you know, this is to me a quite unusual position. I've had some good chats. Well, actually, they amounted to arguments with people who had, you know, very strong about this kind of music, and I have stated, you know, how can you condone what Hollywood produces when you're doing the same thing over here and take away the many times they've simply never thought about it. It's to me, an escape route. It's having your cake and eat it too type of thing, and it's a quite an unfortunate situation that exists, because then when they do hear anything that would classify as good music, sound music, they feel, oh, it's much too uppity or high for us, and they won't even give it a chance to understand. One of the big composers in this era of music, the fellow who wrote that first song, John W. Peterson, is John W. Peterson, who wrote Over the Sunset Mountains. And a favorite story is that he was offered, I don't know how much, by Hollywood for that song if he just let them have it and take out the word Jesus. No, I will not. And so they can justify that it is not of Hollywood, you see. And you know, you go on this way. And I mean, the man is very sincere. I'm not speaking of the sincerity of these people. But the point is that it's an unusual situation. And it's very, very common, unbelievably. So this is another whole big side. When I get back to Minneapolis, I was asked in June, last June, I was called that there's a big convention. I don't even remember what it is in Minneapolis at the auditorium in the first week of September, and they were very anxious. Among the convention, they're going to be premiering a new musical work. A friend of mine called me, and he sort of almost half apologized, and he said, we want to make sure that we have excellent musicians, so if you could arrange for whatever it was, we needed a dozen of the symphony players to, it was on an evening that we didn't have anything, and so could we get the 12 symphony players, mainly brass, to come in to do this piece? And I said, sure, we'll work it out. And what is it? Well, it's a new John W. Peterson work that's just coming out. And I just said, oh. Yeah, I know. Well, it's, he said, well, you know, it's, I mean, well, you know, this is a whole, you know, going on and on and on. I said, okay, yeah, well,